Today's new security broadcast features a conversation with Sherry Goodman and Alice Hill, leaders in the effort to address the impacts of climate change on the security of communities and countries around the world. As a former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, founder of CNA's Military Advisory Board, and a current senior fellow at the Wilson Center, Sherry Goodman has helped the security community understand how climate change is reshaping the security landscape. As Senior Director for Resilience Policy at the NSC under President Obama, Alice Hill helped to shape U.S. government policy on climate change and national security, including the integration of climate resilience into both international and domestic initiatives. In her new book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19, Alice draws on her experience developing U.S. policy across diverse sectors to shed light on what leaders can do today to increase our climate resilience.
Hello, Alice.
Hello, Sherry.
It's terrific to be having this conversation with you about climate, security, and resilience, a field in which you and I have both spent now a considerable amount of our own professional life. And we're going to share with listeners today thoughts about your new book, The Fight for Climate After COVID. And we're also going to talk about the history and context of climate security. So you came to this field during the Obama administration, and why don't you share with us how you came into it and how you came to be focused on the fight for climate after COVID?
Well, you're absolutely right. I came to this rather late in my career. I had a career in the law as a federal prosecutor and then a judge, and I got a phone call. And my life did turn on a dime because on the end of the call was Janet Napolitano, who was about to become Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. She asked me to join her in Washington, which I did. And while I was at DHS, President Obama issued an executive order that required all agencies to engage in adaptation planning. Frankly, in that time, this is 2009, there weren't a lot of volunteers to take on climate change. It was considered politically divisive. It wasn't a career enhancer. And frankly, there just weren't many people working on it. So it fell to me as the new kid on the team, and I began to work on it. And then, as you probably recall, that is when I met you, because you were known as one of the leaders, in fact, the originator of the term threat multiplier, which now is just commonly used when we're talking about climate change. And I met you and you started educating me based on your work, the Center for Naval Analysis, on climate risk. And as I learned more from you and the task force that we assembled at DHS, it was just clear. Climate would affect everything because all of our decisions, all the systems that humans have built rest on the assumption that the climate is stable, that we see a certain range of extremes. And that assumption is turning out to be flawed when you have a blanket of carbon pollution surrounding the globe caused by mostly human activity that traps heat. And that causes the climate to become far less stable, damaging impacts, wildfires, droughts, sea level rise, rain bombs where rain falls in extreme amounts. All those events are highly destabilizing for the systems that we have. So that's how I got started when I was trying to write the Department of Homeland Security's first ever adaptation plan back in 2009.
So tell us where you think we are as a nation and a planet now on dealing with climate resilience. If you were there at the chapter one, essentially, if threat multiplier in my work back in the 2000s was, you know, the very phase zero of defining the problem as a threat multiplier, and your work is essentially in the Obama administration, you know, chapter one on defining sort of climate resilience and filling out that adaptation core. Where do you think we are today in addressing the climate that's already baked into the Earth system?
Well, we're unprepared. And we are missing an opportunity to make sure that our systems are resilient going forward to climate change. To get to having a resilient electric grid, for example, that can operate in the face of wildfires. You know, in California, the world's sixth largest economy, our solution for the threat of wildfires, that's the electric utilities, is to preemptively shut down power. So that means that people are dependent on electric devices for their health, businesses, homes where you're storing food in the refrigerator, all of those things could be at risk as a result of the lack of power because our utilities are not resilient to that. We saw that in Texas as well. We saw extreme freeze and the power system went down and people died in their bed. They froze in their beds. So as we go forward, we need to have resilient systems, but we haven't done that yet. Even as we see the ferocity of events increase, we are seeing that our systems just have not accounted for the future risk. And that is what we need. This is the opportunity now to make sure whenever we make an investment in infrastructure, which is typically particularly expensive and long-lived, we make sure that it will perform in the face of changed conditions over time, or at least we have a way to adapt that infrastructure without having to start all over, retrofit it entirely at great cost. So we need now to invest in this. And the reason it's so important is it's highly cost effective to do so. For every dollar we spend on reducing damages, building a resilient grid, the estimates are it's anywhere from $6 to $7 to $13 in savings on the damage side. So if we can discipline ourselves to invest now in resilience, we'll save money, save lives, save livelihoods.
So that investment in preparedness that you say is so cost effective and saves lives is also one of the hardest political nuts to crack in the US system and probably in most countries around the world because there's inertia. What have you learned through your work and particularly your new book on the fight for climate after COVID, something for which, as you noted, we were vastly underprepared, that we can take away to improve our lot on climate risk?
Well, the takeaway there for COVID is the same takeaway for climate. Early action is very important. With climate, early action is resilience to the impacts that we can no longer avoid. It isn't widely appreciated that because of this blanket of pollution that surrounds the globe, and we continue to add to thicken that blanket with our current emissions, we will have impacts in the future, even if we get our emissions to zero tomorrow, simply because of the delay in the heating. So we need to prepare for those impacts that are at this point unavoidable. We will have those. Of course, we also need an investment in resilience is to cut our emissions. If we do not, we will get into very high degrees of heating, which are in many instances could cause major security risks for populations. People will be on the move to escape conditions that are truly intolerable for human life. So we need to do both, cut emissions and build resilience. Very difficult to do, as you've said, in the political reality. The one takeaway I have is if we can just use the federal government's carrots and sticks to incentivize proper investments, we can have better outcomes. In the resilience area, there's a really great example of this within the federal government. In the 1960s, we looked at the coastal barrier islands, these thin islands that are along the Atlantic coast that aren't well protected from storms. And the federal government decided, you know, it's pretty risky to build on those barrier islands. And it doesn't make sense for the federal government to support development on those islands or to pay for recovery for those who choose to live there. So the federal government said under the Coastal Barrier Resources Act, we're moving out of protecting those areas. Those who want to build there do so at their own risk, and that's their choice. And we need to do a similar thing here and look at the areas that are at the highest risk in the United States. We need to help those who are already in those areas find ways to be able to leave those areas if need be and support those who can't afford to. But we certainly should not be investing going forward in areas that we already know are going to be flooded severely in the future. It just doesn't make fiscal sense for our limited tax dollars to go into that. If the federal government does uses that carrot and stick process, it gives a signal to those who make the decisions about where people live and how they build, and that's state and local governments. So it's sending a message to those who are making those decisions on the ground. You can make those decisions. It's not the job of the federal government to tell you what to do, but if you want federal money to support you in those choices, you will need to make choices that protect taxpayer dollars and aren't just building in areas that we know will be damaged and then have to have a big payout by the federal government to help those communities get back on their feet.
So I live in one of those areas that's been protected by the barrier beaches on Cape Cod. And, you know, we have beautiful undeveloped beaches that are regularly battered by now climate fueled storms, but nonetheless, they provide a level of protection that we would not otherwise have. And we have lots of conservation land that is well protected as well. How would America change? How would our coastal regions change today if we put in place what you described? What would some of our cities like Miami look like if we really acted on better limiting development in highly vulnerable areas?
Well, we would see that communities wouldn't be in areas that are subject to repeated flooding unless we build flood protections that protect them. So that's a choice that needs to be made within the community. But we wouldn't have, for example, a flood insurance program that is not reflecting the true risk. We right now have major reforms underway on the flood insurance program to make sure that the premiums that are charged to homeowners better reflect the true risk. Now, it's a graduated program because for so long, the National Flood Insurance Program has not rated its pricing according to the risk. And now they're going to do that. And one of the wonderful outcomes of this is that some people will save money. They were paying too much under the old system. They were paying for those who are living in riskier areas. And it really becomes important when we're looking at communities that may have been redlined or placed in areas they've been historically disadvantaged and marginalized, and they've been placed in areas that are at great risk of flooding. We need to look at those communities and help them as the federal government begins to try to signal, we'll provide you insurance, but your insurance will reflect the true risk. That's what the private insurance industry does. And the reason the private insurance industry does that is because they can't make money if they don't charge the rate that reflects the risk of loss to that company. And the federal government isn't in the business of making money, but it still doesn't want to end up with all losses. It's not a sustainable program. That's actually what's happened with the National Flood Insurance Program. It has repeatedly gone back to Congress because itself is underwater and has needed huge infusions of cash, billions of dollars, to keep it afloat. So here, what we need is to look at the programs that we have and work with communities to encourage them to make sure that their building codes reflect the kinds of impacts they'll have and their land use choices are looking at. Will this building be flooded repeatedly during the life of the building for a home that's 30 years or a larger structure that could be longer? We need to ask those questions now. And it's not that the communities can't do it. It's the question of should the federal taxpayers' dollars, should someone in Minnesota be supporting development that's in areas at known significant risk to damage from events that are worsened by climate.
So do you see evidence that incentivized change is on the way in the action either of the current administration or and Congress supporting it?
Well, we have one very clear example, which I worked on when I was in the Obama administration, and that is the National Flood Standard. The National Flood Standard came out of nation's experience with Superstorm Sandy. We saw that homes that had not been elevated, it's pretty simple to understand, the higher the home, water will wash through underneath and less damage from flooding will occur. And Superstorm Sandy taught us that a lot of our homes were not elevated and they were severely damaged. But in rebuilding, the desire was to make sure that we elevate those homes that are already existing and make sure that the water can wash through. Superstorm Sandy Rebuilding Task Force recommended that the federal government create a national federal flood standard for homes that the federal government is supporting financially, either through whatever means, that these be elevated if they are at risk of flooding, including from climate change worsened events. And President Obama signed that executive order. I led the development of it. President Trump, 10 days before Harvey dumped about 4 feet of rain on Houston, revoked that order. But President Biden has brought it back. And it's somewhat groundbreaking in that we've never really had a federal building standard, but this will help make sure that homes are raised and avoid flooding damage. The standard doesn't get to the issue of land use, which is a separate challenge, but at least for those homes that are already flooded and FEMA's coming back and the families are going to stay, we're raising the homes.
So in light of what you would call that one success on flooding in a federal flood standard, do you think we need federal standards for other climate perils for, say, for example, for fire, other sea level rise? Are there other federal standards that would help us advance our ability to make America more resilient?
Well, we have done another federal standard. We did a wildfire standard when I was in the White House. I led the development of that. Now, that standard only applied to federal buildings. And of course, the federal government owns a huge number of buildings across the United States, and some of them are at risk of wildfire. Essentially, it requires when we rebuild, if they're destroyed by wildfire or if they are being built new, they are built to the latest standards. And one of the things I learned in the process of doing that is when the federal government sets those own standards for itself, the local communities sometimes choose to follow that standard for themselves. They follow the federal example. We were told that. We were told that it would be important to do this because it would encourage state and local communities. The way our building codes are created here in the United States is through a number of non-governmental organizations. They develop model codes, and then each state or community can decide whether or not to adopt the building codes. And this is an area that we need to work on to make sure that the model codes that are available to state and local communities reflect future climate risk. That is ongoing work. It has not been achieved yet. And there are a number of ideas of how to do it. For example, in New Zealand and Japan, they use more of a performance-based code. Our code is more prescriptive. It sort of tells you how to build. Their codes look at, will the structure last? And in Japan, they've done groundbreaking work on making sure that buildings survive earthquakes. I remember this story from an acquaintance of mine. You'll recall the earthquake in Sendai that caused the Fukushima disaster. And he lived in a high-rise building in Sendai. The night before the earthquake, his family had gathered. They were going off on a trip and they celebrated with champagne and they were leaving early in the morning. They left those very slender champagne flutes sitting on the counter in the kitchen. And they went off. And of course, there was this devastating earthquake that followed. And my acquaintance told me when he came back to his apartment, the champagne flutes were just intact. They were still standing. And that's because Japan has emphasized it wants its buildings not only to protect life, that's what we focus on here in the United States. Can people get out in time? Are they gonna, we don't want them to get killed in the buildings if a bad thing happens. Japan has taken a step forward. We want the building to perform after the bad event because those are people's homes, that's where businesses are, and we need to be able to carry on with our lives. So there's a lot of work to be done in building codes, and the federal government can certainly provide incentives to encourage the development of the kinds of building codes that will protect us going forward.
So let's talk about how we strike the right balance between mitigation and adaptation or resilience. You focused a lot on resilience, Alice, the climate resilience. The Climate Conference of the Parties in Glasgow is thought to be primarily about the mitigation end or reducing our emissions, carbon emissions. And I sometimes say we need to be able to walk and chew gum. We have to be able to do both. How do we get to a place where we can really address the resilience building we need, as well as take significant action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are two sides, maybe more, of climate change. There's the mitigation, the cut the harmful pollution, and there's the adaptation or resilience, preparing for the impacts. Those two communities have been historically separated, different people working in the areas, different disciplines, and different metrics. In fact, there's no really good metric for adaptation or resilience. There's a much easier metric for mitigation, how many tons of carbon you've avoided emitting. And since this issue really emerged on the world stage in the late 80s in the United States, when a NOAA scientist testified before Congress that he was very sure that humans were causing the globe to heat up, it has been mostly a discussion of mitigation. And I think that's because scientists and others who are involved in this very much hoped that we would get the carbon pollution under control, and we wouldn't have to really adapt much. If we had kept our carbon pollution down, we wouldn't be heating up. That hasn't occurred. Last year, despite the pandemic, we had the greatest accumulation of carbon ever in the atmosphere. So we are continuing to create that blanket that's going to heat us up. So adaptation is now necessary, and it's very important, getting to your question, that these two communities work together, even though it's been treated separately. And the reason for that is they're both at risk for making decisions that will not look sound in hindsight if they ignore what the other side of the coin, those experts, are doing. We've got these expressions, malmitigation, maladaptation. We need to make sure that we are considering both. What does an adaptation choice mean for emissions? And what does a mitigation choice mean for adaptation?
What will a successful COP look like for you, Alice? What do you want to see in terms of the resilience and adaptation components?
Well, as our UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has said, adaptation needs to take equal footing with mitigation. And this is particularly important when it comes to the developing world. The developed world will have many severe, we're not immune from climate impacts, but we have infrastructure that better protects us, notably flood infrastructure, deep investments in flood infrastructure that had been done over years, hundreds, centuries. We built those flood protections and we continue to improve them. Those don't typically exist in the developing world, and so they're more vulnerable to greater damage or at least greater risk. So we need to see, in the face of that, more help for the developing world to adapt. And most immediately, it would be things like early warning systems. 200 some nations in the world, just about half of them don't really have sound early warning systems, according to the World Meteorological Organization. And without a sound warning, early warning system, people can't evacuate, they can't protect their homes, their livelihoods, if they have chickens outside or a goat or whatever, get their tools and secured, whatever it is. And when these events hit the developing world, it can cause a family just to spiral into poverty very quickly. Early warning system is critical for saving lives, but also assisting people in reducing their damage. The early warning systems depend on a good meteorological weather, good weather forecasting system, which depends on having the infrastructure to do weather forecasting, to get the data, to analyze it, and then communicate that. And that's missing in many countries. Basically, in Africa, it's most of Africa is missing that. So we need to make deep investments to help these countries understand their risks and warn their populations in advance, and be really good if we could get them some money based on those warnings so that they could make small investments to protect themselves. We've seen this done where if there's going to be a flood, give the community money or supplies like hand sanitizer, water purifiers, whatever it is, so that they get through the flood without having even greater harm. Lots of ideas to do this, lots of promising steps. We need to scale it up now because these events are increasing in severity and they're occurring more often.
So it sounds like you're saying we need to create a culture of preparedness across
yes.
the world.
Yes.
And that's really your mantra. We have a responsibility to prepare, as some of us have written, yourself included, and create really that as an overall framework or paradigm. So why don't you close with giving us your final words, Alice, about how we can move together as both a country and a planet towards a better culture of preparedness?
Well, I think the first step before we get to a culture of preparedness is engagement. What I would share is that, as you heard, I got this assignment to work on climate change by happenstance. It was not considered desirable at all. But as I've worked on it, we've also seen climate change coming to the fore. There's much greater appreciation of what is at stake. And one of the things that I find has been a wonderful surprise for me is how exciting it is to be engaged in this field and feeling as if there are things that I can contribute to and that I can join with others to build that will have greater results. So my message to most people is I see sometimes a sense of being overwhelmed by climate change. It's just too big. I just, you know, and then there's a shutting down because people don't want to get depressed. And my approach and my pitch is this is the Full Employment Act. Jobs are going to require knowledge about climate change because it's going to affect everything. But there's joy. And that's a word I don't use lightly. I borrowed it from a minister friend of mine. He described the joy he found in this work. And that's what I have found. And I just want to encourage people to engage. And then as we engage, we can help build the political will that's necessary for all of us to understand our risks and then make the choices that will keep us safer. But before we can get to a culture of preparedness, we have to all be beginning to understand what is climate change about? What will it mean for me? What will it mean for my community? And then what can I bring to this fight that can have a better outcome and help build the kind of resilient, prepared world that we want for ourselves, our children, our grandchildren going forward?
Well, Alice, you know, like you, I came to environmental security because I started out in national security and defense. And as a young female professional, I was assigned the portfolio that nobody else wanted. which
again, we share a past, right?
There we go. Oversight of the nuclear weapons complex. And when it failed, I went from weapons to waste. And that became environment in defense and national security. And so, but you're right. You're very right that what's happened over the years is these fields that no one else wanted, we took on, and now they are the place to be. And they are the place, you're right, of joy and engagement. And I would leave our listeners, particularly our younger listeners, that this is where you're going to make your mark, starting from maybe where we're going to be ending. But taking in this field and these related fields of climate, security, resilience, adaptation, and a whole climate action into a whole new area of innovation, entrepreneurship, and hopefully a culture of global preparedness.
Well said.
Well, Alice, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And good luck. We all look forward to reading your book, The Fight for Climate After COVID.
Thanks so much, Sherry. What a pleasure. And thank you for all you have done in this field.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecurityBeat.org.